We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 25th of May, 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch, your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. And as ever, we are broadcasting live from the Sheffield Live radio studio in the centre of Sheffield. We're going out on FM radio, we're going out through our internet live stream too, and however you're listening, the programme is also available as a podcast later from the Sheffield Live website. Talking about podcasts, did you hear last week's programme or did you miss it? If you missed it, Rachel Fletcher was on the show. She was talking about how you can bid for public sector tenders. We also had Noel O'Connor, a sleep expert, on the programme talking about a revolutionary new pillow that he's invented. Now, he's spent 25 years working to support people with neck problems. He knows his stuff. Rachel has been helping people successfully bid for tenders for many years too. So if you missed last week's programme, panic not. The podcast is up on the Sheffield Live website. Go to sheffieldlive.org, look up radio shows, find Business Live, and the podcast is there. But that was then, this is now. Who's on today? And I'm really delighted to welcome Richard Holmes, Chief Executive of the King's Foundation, onto the programme today. We'll be hearing from him in a couple of minutes. But before we do, what's been going on in business and in social enterprise? What's been going on with you? Well, I've noticed a release from the Federation of Small Business. They got in touch to tell us that labour costs are front of mind for small firms, and utility and fuel bill rises are causing stress and worries. They say that the number of small firms reporting a rise in operating expenditure is at a near record high. Fuel and utility costs are weighing on growth ambitions. They say that more than 7 in 10 small firms report a rise in operating costs in quarter two of 2018. That's up 10 percentage points compared to the same period in 2016. It's close to a record high proportion recorded 6 months ago. Now, utilities have been flagged as a main cause of rising operating costs by more than a third of small firms, 36%, with many saying fuel and is a primary driver. And Claire Redding, she's the development manager at the Federation for Small Businesses, said that higher inflation continues to make life uncomfortable for small firms. The pain felt by consumers is also felt by businesses, and that one in three small firms now sees weak consumer demand as a main barrier to growth. Now, is that something that's affecting your business, your social enterprise? If it is, and you want to get in touch, you can do so. I'll give contact details out in a moment or two. Save a date. Social Saturday. The date for Social Saturday this year, the fifth year of Social Saturday, has now been announced. It's in October. I know that might seem like a while away, but put the date in your diaries now. Saturday, the 13th of October. Fifth year of Social Saturday, the biggest UK-wide initiative dedicated to celebrating and raising awareness of UK social enterprises, businesses, as you know, which trade for a social or environmental purpose. And Social Saturday has gone from strength to strength. It's reached millions of people through local events, through national and regional media coverage, and through online platforms as well. And it's a chance to shine a spotlight on social enterprises. We shine a spotlight on social enterprises every week on this programme, but to show the difference they're making in communities across the country. And there has been a dramatic growth in the social enterprise movement over the last few years. And listeners will know Sheffield itself is a social enterprise city now. Social enterprises are earning income, they are trading, but they're also tackling head-on some of the biggest challenges that we face as a nation, whether it's housing, climate change, homelessness, many, many, many more, helping to regenerate communities to create jobs, create great opportunities as well. So Social Saturday 2018, Saturday the 13th of October, there are going to be events happening throughout the week, Monday the 8th, all the way through to the end of the week, and details on Social Enterprise UK's website. Go to socialenterprise.org.uk. What else has been going on? Well, I don't know if your inbox is anything like mine, but it is absolutely full of begging emails. It feels like I'm being stalked by desperate exes saying, please, may I continue to write to you? Please, please, please keep me on your list. But of course, I signed up to be on their list in the first place anyway, in many cases. And if I didn't sign up to be on their list, and they've just added me to their list, are these people likely to want to bother to comply with the new General Data Protection Regulation, which comes into effect today? So this is across Europe, and lots of people have been focusing on the marketing and the marketing consent element of GDPR. And of course, if you didn't get consent for your, if you run an email list to email potential customers, and you didn't actually get consent and merrily added loads of people onto your list, well, that's now illegal. So you do need consent to be sending people emails. But lots and lots of organizations actually did get specific consent that met GDPR requirements in the first place. But now they've been desperately sending emails saying, please resubscribe, please resubscribe. They've put themselves into a position where if people don't resubscribe to their lists, they won't be allowed to send them emails anymore. Lots of confusion. And of course, GDPR goes way, way, way beyond just marketing consent, as we explored in this program a few weeks ago when Heather Anson was on the show. She's one of the UK's foremost experts in data legislation, and she talked about the wider elements of GDPR as well. Anyway, whatever you think of the rules, which give the Information Commissioner's Office powers to fine firms up to 20 million euros or 4% of their global annual turnover for serious breaches, you may or may not be fully prepared, because it isn't just about whether people have opted into your list. There's lots, lots more. I mean, for example, if you carry your laptop around, as many of us do, and you have data on it, and it isn't password protected, and your laptop were to be stolen, and someone were to harvest the data from your laptop, you haven't properly, adequately protected that. If people can easily hack into your data, there are far, far, far wider implications too. Now, the boss of the Information Commissioner's Office was on BBC Radio 4 this morning, and she said that businesses, that small businesses, obviously they do need to take this seriously. You should be taking this seriously. But it is not the case that the ICO are going to try and make examples out of small businesses that accidentally get things wrong. They want to see that you're committed to getting it right. So if you haven't done anything about this, then do take a look at the Information Commissioner's Office website, where they have 12 steps to prepare for GDPR. And as I say, Elizabeth Denham, she's the Information Commissioner. And this morning she said small businesses won't be coming under close scrutiny if they don't make extensive use of data. The focus is initially going to be on big companies, particularly those in the tech sector. Small businesses shouldn't panic, she said, if they suffer a data breach, but they should be taking basic steps to protect data. So, so take a look at the ICO's steps to prepare, if you haven't already. Right, what's coming up in business and in social enterprise in Sheffield that you might like to attend? Well, the business and intellectual property sector, property centre, have loads of free events about market research, about protecting your intellectual property, copyright, much, much, much more. They're located at the Central Library, Sheffield. Accountancy as well, business legal advice, loads more. You can give them a call on 0114 273 4712, or you can find out more about the events that they offer on their Eventbrite page. Go to eventbrite.co.uk and look up Business and IP Centre Sheffield for more details. So I think that's enough from me. Without further ado, it's time to turn to our guest for today. And I'm really pleased that Richard Holmes, who's chief executive of the King's Foundation, has come into the studio. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. thank you very much for coming in today. How are you?
It's a pleasure. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Very good.
Excellent. Super. Now, I know a little bit about King's Foundation and what you do, but I'd like you to tell our listeners in your own words. What's the King's Foundation?
Sure. Well, we're a not-for-profit. We've been established for 27 years. And our mission is simple, really, to get children active, having fun and learning together. And we've been doing that, as I say, for 27 years. We've worked with around 1.5 million children, around 40,000 young people. So, we're facing, it was interesting in your narrative before, the social issues that social enterprise face. And ours is very much about getting children active at a time where we know that increasingly children are less active. They're spending more and more time in front of screens. And there are lots and lots of social effects, negative social effects, not all negative, but a lot of negative social effects of them spending so much time in front of screens. So we are on a mission to get children active. We do that in a very creative, fun way. And that's what we've been doing for many, many years.
Right. Grand. So you've mentioned children spending a lot of time in front of screens. And we've seen European-wide statistics on obesity and the levels of obesity, or the number of children who are either overweight or obese when they leave primary school, for example. Yeah. And the UK isn't necessarily the worst in Europe, but the stats are fairly worrying when we look at those in terms of, because of the potential implications on health and physical health and mental health, if people haven't been necessarily participating in healthy activities. So you you mentioned 40,000 children.
We've worked with over 1.5 million children,
right.
And every year. So we do it in a variety of different ways. We run King's camps during the summer holidays and all the main school holidays, where parents drop their children off for the day, and we look after them. And children in a week will try up to 20 or 30 different activities, from normal things like football and basketball and things like that, to some creative ideas. We do bubble football, we do archery tag, we do lots and lots of sports and activities, but all in a very creative, fun way. So it's a way of engaging children from an early age. We don't want to put children off through sports excellence. I'm a keen sportsman, so I'm all for sports excellence.
Yes.
And not against that at all. But that's very much the domain of clubs, whereas we are more about getting children active from an early age and developing a love for sport and physical activity rather than putting them in a very competitive environment immediately. And we find that model is a great encouragement to maybe lots of children who otherwise wouldn't want to put themselves in that type of situation.
Right, yes. So that's a model that actually engages.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's good for inclusivity and accessibility here.
Yeah, and the other thing, we employ a lot of young people to work on our program. So over the years, around 40,000 young people, we've got into employment through the organisation.
That was where I had the 40,000 number.
And around 60% of those work on our day camps across the UK. So we have a place in Sheffield. We run it at the high school. We were at the university for many years. But we have 62 locations across the UK where we run these programmes. And a lot of the young people work on those programmes. And they are real role models to the children that come onto the camps. Many of the young people are doing a sports-related degree or they're in the teaching profession. We have something called the King's Factor, which we look for some special qualities of enthusiasm, of commitment to children, fun, all those factors that make up what we call our red tops, our red uniform, which is pretty famous these days. And they are real role models for children. So rather than it being a pupil-teacher relationship, which happens during the school term, this is very much more like a peer-to-peer relationship. They're role models for the younger children. And we very much see that children from as young as 5 look up to their 8-year-olds that are doing sport. The 8-year-olds look up to their teens that are doing sport and being free to be themselves. No phones, no screen time, just be children being children, really. And our young people that lead those programs are great role models.
Right, fantastic. So some impressive statistics there in terms of the work that you've done and the numbers of children and young people that you've worked with. You mentioned King's Foundation as a non-profit. And so how does it work in terms of how are your activities supported and paid for? How do you bring revenue streams in to do what you do?
Sure. Since our inception in 91, we got our charitable status. Yes. The only thing we did then was run these activities camps, King's Camps, which we still do today. Parents pay us, so they are members of the organisation. They, in effect, pay a membership fee so that their children can come onto our programme. So that's still 80% of our revenue generation comes from that. So although we're a not-for-profit, we're an interesting model because we are 99% self-sustaining financially. Yes. So there's the camp revenue that we receive, and we've also over the years developed two other strands of our work which are income generating. So first was a recruitment organisation called King's Recruit, and we recruit young people to work for our programmes, but increasingly we recruit young people to work in activity jobs with other organisations that we work with. And those organisations pay us to recruit and verify great young people to work on their children's programmes. So that's another revenue stream that's enabled us to be self-sustaining financially. And I guess the third strand is something we called King's Active, which in effect is our business-to-business model, where we've gone out... well, I'll take you back to, I was on a Eurocamp holiday back about, I want to say 15 years ago now. My boys were younger. We were on a site somewhere in southern France, and there was a typical children's club there, face painting and things. And my children were sports mad, or are sports mad, and they're saying, "Dad, I really don't want to go to that fairly ordinary looking sort of children's club. I want to do sport." And it suddenly struck a chord with me. And when I came back off the holiday, I approached Eurocamp and said, "Look, this is my boy's experience. This is what we do as an organisation. Why don't we help you to create an amazingly active sports programme on your holiday parks?" And actually, we struck gold. They took us on. We worked with Eurocamp for about 10 years. And that was our starting point into working with lots of other organisations who have children's programmes. So the cruise sector, families increasingly go on cruise ships.
Yes.
And so the cruise market's gone from an ageing market into a family market. But they don't really know, or didn't really know, how to engage children, because cruising is all about entertainment, standing on a stage and entertaining adults. And then suddenly they were faced with hundreds of children on these ships and having to engage them for 8 to 10 hours a day, not entertain them. So they turned to us. We started to work with Cunard Line, the QM2 and QE2. And since then, we've worked with seven out of eight of the largest cruise companies in the world. And I would say we've had a very significant impact on the way children are viewed, the way children are engaged on ships, and a very active program now on many of the ships. And so that's been an incredible journey for us. And again, financially, it's been great. They pay us to do this and to provide these services. So we design their programs, we audit their programs, we make sure they're safe. And then we also recruit and train young people to go and lead their programs. So King's Active has been a significant part of our income generation and also fulfilling our mission, getting children active, having fun and learning together.
Absolutely. So that makes a lot of sense there. You're helping these large organisations working internationally to achieve things that they simply couldn't do to the quality that you can. And you're not only designing programs, you're helping them to recruit, as you say, for example, and much, much, much more. And that's... clearly, Eurocamp opened doors to you in terms of working with the cruise companies and so on. And you also have a range of other corporate partners as well, I noticed, on the website. So tell me a little bit more about
those. Work primarily in sort of the holiday leisure market. So Thomas Cook, some of the resort-based companies we've done a lot of work with as well. Again, designing children's programs for them so that children aren't just being entertained, but they're engaged, they're active, they're participating in events. So again, I'd like to think we've made a significant mark in that sector.
Yes.
And then I guess the fourth area of our work is that we're really passionate about training at community level.
Yes.
And so we've had an office in Southern Africa, in Botswana, for about 12 years now. And 12 years ago, we took a team over there. We were invited by one of our connections through one of our staff members to Botswana. I didn't even know where Botswana was at the time. But that was the start of an incredible journey for us, really.
Right.
We reviewed our model a few years later, and actually what we knew to be right was how would we use our limited resources in the most effective way. And it was about training local people in their community in a very simple way. How can they use sport and activity as a way of building community, engaging community? And we now work with some of the big development agencies, World Vision, Tier Fund, etc. And they bring us in as a specialist to engage their community leaders. That might be teachers, it might be health workers, it may be church workers, faith-based groups, and we come in and we have something called the Base Pack, which is a beautifully designed pack of equipment. Very simple, and we go in, and it's a scalable, affordable model. The development agencies see sport increasingly as a great tool for development, so we go in and we train local leaders how to use sport and fun activities engaged to engage children. So just a recent example of that is a big project for World Vision in Zimbabwe, yep, to get girls to be more engaged with education. Often the girls in the rural communities, they have other responsibilities. They have to collect water, they have to look after siblings, and there's a very high dropout rate in schools.
Yes.
So they've turned to us to help them, to be a part in their solution. So we go in and train the teachers to use the Base Pack and sports and active games to make school more engaging. So they may start a maths lesson now with a fun activity and a game, an active game, which means the girls are attentive, it's gender neutral, so it really encourages participation.
Yes.
So there's an example of the type of wider work that we do. We're very proud of that work, and we're working now in around 9 or 10 different countries in sub-Saharan Africa. We're doing some remote training with Burundi this weekend. We've done work with leaders in Pakistan, etc. So we see that work as something that we want to scale and do more of.
Right. Okay, great. So you're ambitious for that to scale further, yeah, and clearly making a significant impact with that work as well. So in terms of a positive intervention or a positive support, yeah, in terms of using the power of sport to engage and to develop community.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So this is fascinating. Now, you've talked about the foundation being set up at the start of the 90s. Mm. Now, you yourself, your own personal journey with the foundation, you have worked to get children active for 25 or years or longer yourself. So it seems to me that you're very, very aligned as CEO. You're obviously going to be aligned with the organisation that you're running with mission and values. But how did King's Foundation, how did it come to be? What was the spark that set the flame? How did it come to be created and set up?
Yeah.
And what led to your involvement?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's an interesting journey, and the guy that started it was somebody called Nigel Floodgate. I can't take credit for that, for starting the organisation. He was a PE teacher in London. He went and did Camp America, which is what a lot of young people did back then. And he saw the opportunity. He was very entrepreneurial, probably the most entrepreneurial person I've actually ever met. And he came back to the UK seeing this gap in the market. Summer camps for kids in the States had been going for part of the institution, part of the culture there. But there was nothing back in the late 80s, early 90s. There was no provision in the school holidays for children in the UK. So he saw a gap in the market. He started to run a private organisation in London, ran it for 2 years, became very, very successful, quit his PE job. Then he had a revolution in his life, and I'm not fully sure the order of this, but basically he came to Sheffield, he met his future wife, and he also came to faith and started to attend a church in Netheredge called the King Centre, still going today. I had just started attending the church with my wife as well at the time, and we got to know each other, and Nigel invited me to be one of the first board members. So actually I was a trustee before I was an employee.
Right, I see.
And then not long after, about 6 months later, I was on a marketing career, safe job. I'd got a very young family, newly married, mortgage. So I had a load of responsibilities all of a sudden, and I needed to pay the bills. I was in a safe, relatively safe marketing career, doing well. And then I got a call from Nigel saying, why don't you, I don't think this is going to work for me. I want to move back to London before this really gets legs. Why don't you take it on? I think you'd be really good at it. So I was one of those positions in life where it was stick or twist.
Yes, indeed.
It wasn't a smart choice. It was not the sort of choice you go home and tell your parents about, because King's at the time was, we had a bit of sports equipment in the cupboard at the creche at the King's Centre. We had a phone, a desk and a filing cabinet with a few documents in. So it was a real fledgling organisation. But there was just something there that was, for me, incredibly attractive. The mission of the organisation to get children active, run these camps for kids. The opportunity to be involved in a startup, really, in a fledgling organisation. And then also, I guess, a faith element to that as well. Being able to exercise my passion for sport, which I believe is God-given, and to be able to use that for good. So bringing those three elements together, for me, it was a turning point in my life. It was a tipping point. I had a big decision to take. Thankfully, my amazing wife, Lorraine, said, yes, let's do this. And we jumped almost overnight into that fledgling organisation. And the rest, as they say, is history.
The rest indeed is history. But yes, as you say, a massive decision to make. And it's very difficult for people to leave a safe career where there is a salary coming in to jump into something, into the unknown, which may or may not work. Obviously, you were entirely committed to making it work. But it's something that we've talked about a lot on this programme when people talk about leaving the confines, the safety blanket of a job to do what, to follow their dream, to follow their passion, to set up their entity, their business or their social enterprise. Now, you've described some of that, and you've described the support from your wife to make it work. And, you know, you had responsibilities, young family at the time. Now, did you have remorse at all? Did you think, what have I done? I've just quit the job.
I think it was youthful naivety more than a beautifully crafted plan. I think probably if I was faced with that decision now, it'd be tougher. But at the time, I guess youthful optimism, youthful naivety probably played a big part. I probably didn't fully appreciate the step I was taking.
Right.
And thankfully, it went swimmingly well. You know, we had this amazing model. There was a hunger in the market. We played to the market. We grew very, very quickly. We went from initial camps in Sheffield, Leeds and Bradford with a few hundred children. And we within 5 years, we were at 20, 25 locations in the UK. And we were really on a roll. One of the early things I remember, this is pre-internet, pre-web, pre-online bookings. Remarkable, really, to think pre-any of that. But I used to drive into the King Centre in the morning and there was a post box on the wall outside. And the church used to receive about three letters a week in the post box. And then when the camp started to get momentum, I'd arrive at the peak of booking time and there would literally be sacks of letters piling out of the letterbox, but also on the floor that the postman had left there in the morning. And the adrenaline, the buzz of that, knowing that you were onto something, that you were meeting a need, you were growing an enterprise, was in some ways, they're the things you miss when you reach maturity in an organisation, because you can't replicate the early living on the edge sort of part of a startup. And I used to go in and my morning was filled with opening envelopes, processing checks, taking the checks to the bank, manually filling in booking forms, phoning people up and talking about their booking for their children. So it was incredibly exciting. I used to put an answer machine on and the phone calls in the evenings and weekends came to our home, and Lorraine used to answer the phone, and it was an all-encompassing startup feel, which you know, anyone that started their own organization understands that's what it's like in the early days.
Yes, most definitely. Absolutely. And so initially then you were running camps in Sheffield, in Leeds, in four locations quite quickly in the UK. As you said earlier, culturally in America, summer camps have been something that people have done for many, many years. You know, activity camps.
Yes,
this was really fairly new for the UK in the 90s. There wasn't much of it going on anyway. You've really brought this to, I hesitate to say mass market, but you've made it something that far, far more people do. Now, for some people, it's a case of, I suppose, parents sending their kids to summer camp because both parents need to work childcare and so on in summer. For others, it's a motivation of the camp itself. A whole range of mixed reasons for doing so, I suppose. The idea of adventure and children being given opportunities to try different activities, to try different sports they might not other have.
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole load of drivers.
Yes.
We definitely don't position ourselves as a childcare operator.
No.
However, the harsh reality is we know that.
Right.
Parents, yeah. Working parents increasingly, again, going back to our roots, still, it was fairly, I would guess, the norm that mums stayed at home and looked after their kids. And that was beginning to change. And that's why our organisation really grew legs, because increasingly, both parents were going to work. And so what do they do during the school holidays? It's a very big issue. So we can't deny that many parents choose us as an affordable but also a very constructive way of leaving their children. But we primarily position ourselves as an experience for children. We never want to just become a childcare operator. Mm. Some of our commercial competitors very much position themselves as childcare operators. That's fine, but it's not our mission. Our mission is to get children active, having fun, learning together. And we do that in a large part through our summer programs, our summer camps and Easter, etc. So there are different motivations for families. We know we provide a service for working parents, but we don't want to just be childcare and viewed as that.
No, understood. Okay, fine, thanks. So, Richard, you've talked about those early days. You've talked about the excitement of a startup, if you like, a growing organisation that loads of us listening to the show will recognise that, will have been through that with organisations, businesses, social enterprises, other organisations that we've created and set up and grown and so on. So you get King's Foundation, you get King's Camps going. Soon you're operating in four cities. Mm. Four locations, then more. That was at the 90s. Now you're working as a partner with many commercial organisations too. It's been obviously phenomenal in terms of the numbers of people that you've worked with. You've talked about that at the start of the programme. What have been the biggest challenges, though, over the nearly three decades of operation? What have been the biggest challenges, difficulties that you've faced?
Last night I watched the Marks and Spencer documentary about the demise of M&S.
Right.
And I think M&S is a classic example of a brand, high street brand that everyone loved. And they started to become complacent, I guess. I have nothing against M&S. I wish them well. My mum is an avid M&S supporter still. I grew up with M&S.
Yes.
But it is a classic high street brand, isn't it, that suffered from a degree of complacency. And I guess the biggest challenge for any organisation is never to think you've cracked it. So one of the biggest challenges is keeping going every day, I think, as an entrepreneur, as a leader, as a management team, as an organisation. You can't really have a day off. I think there's this myth that you get to a point and it runs itself. Well, it may work for a few, but I think for most of us, you just have to keep going. And I guess that is a challenge at times where you feel you've put the hard yards in. It should just run itself. But I think most organisations don't just run themselves. And there is a danger if you take that approach that complacency can set in and that then the competitors move in and overtake you very, very quickly. And I'm running a not-for-profit, but we have to talk about competition because the reality is for every organisation, for-profit, not-for-profit, social enterprises, we're all in a competitive environment and therefore we have to think about the market, we have to think about our competitors. So I guess it's the challenge of just turning up day after day, week after week, month after month. I think that's the biggest challenge. But it's also, it's an amazing privilege to be able to do that. So I think complacency is a word we throw around at King's a lot. We never want to be complacent. So one of the big issues we're facing at the moment in the not-for-profit sector, when you're working with people and young people and children, is safeguarding.
Yes,
it's one of the big, with GDPR, safeguarding. Yep. They're the two big compliance issues this year that we're really focused on working hard. GDPR, I'm sure you've talked about a lot here, and today's the day, but we put ourselves in a really good position with that because we have to look after children's data. Is there anything more important than safeguarding children's data? But safeguarding as an issue has hit the headlines for all the wrong reasons in the last 6 months, and some of the big development agency, Oxfam and Save the Children, again, a bit like M&S, was it complacency? Was it a bit of arrogance? I'm not sure, that crept in. And they're on the front pages of the news for the wrong reasons. And we, culturally as an organisation, we are about children. So if any organisation needs to be strong on safeguarding, it should be us. And we are. But this last 6 months, we've got even better. We've put in an internal safeguarding team now, which goes from people on the front line, our red tops working with kids, all the way through to board level, taking it very, very seriously. And that's good because it puts us in an even stronger position for ourselves, but also to go and advise other organisations. How can you work more safely with children? So it's compliance can be a bit of a pain, like GDPR, but actually, if you embrace it, it can actually be a real product differentiator as well in the marketplace, which is the view we're taking.
Right. Grand. I see. Okay. And so you are now able to be able to provide expert advice to other organizations. I'm glad you brought up safeguarding. It was one of my questions for you. So,
and in fact, we've just done some online learning, which we use extensively for our own coaches, for our red tops. We've just written an online learning course for a third party we work with, and it's purely on safeguarding. How can they safeguard the children in their care? So we see that as a real area of growth for us actually in the future. But obviously we can only do that from a point of real strength.
Right, yes, I see. Okay. So, and what about you personally? I mean, you've talked about some degree of... you talked about complacency in terms of organisational complacency and how organisations have to evolve, have to develop, have to continually innovate and have to appreciate the people with whom they work, not take them for granted, not be complacent. And you've talked about your commitment to, I suppose, ensuring that King's moves forward.
Yeah.
You talked a little bit about leadership there as well, but as a leader, as CEO, what advice would you give to other leaders, perhaps who are, you know, you've been a leader for 25 plus years, people perhaps a little bit earlier on in their leadership career, a new chief executive, what do you know now that you wish you'd known back then, or what advice could you give to other leaders?
we have a bookshelf at King's where people in the team are able to buy any book they want, read it, do a short review, circulate it to the team, put it on the bookshelf, and then others can read that. And one of the books I wish I'd read earlier, in answer to your question, is a book that was written in the 30s, a very well-known book, sold millions and millions of copies, which is How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. The language in it is a little bit antiquated now, but it's still a book, because I get a lot of young guys that are working for the organisation. They do tend to come to me and say, so come on, time for a question. Give me some tips. How can I be better at what I am? And I always recommend that book for them because it's a book that's very simple, but it's about the ability to listen to what others say. How do you influence, how do you win friends and influence people? Isn't by talking about yourself, actually. Mm. And he's amazing in the way he brings that out. And I wish I'd read that book earlier because actually listening and always having a spirit of learning, I think, is one of the key tips I would give. Never to think you know it. Always, in every environment, coming in here this morning, what can I learn? What's new? What can I take from this? Not, it's just about me and what I can give. Mm. So I think that would be the first, is always have a spirit of learning and a spirit of openness. And definitely, I'd like to think King's is an organisation that's part of our culture, that there's no arrogance, there's no complacency. We have done some amazing things, but we have a mission, and the mission is we're a tiny pinprick into that mission, into achieving that mission. So we've got a long, long way to go. Our numbers are sort of impressive, but we're not Google, we're not Facebook. We've got a long, long way to go. So, yeah, listen, learn, read that book. they'd be early, some of the lessons I sort of suggest people could take.
Right, fantastic. Thank you very much for that, Richard. And what we're going to do now, I think that's an apt moment to take a quick break for a track of music. And this is a track that you've chosen. It is Thinking of You. It's by Sister Sledge. It's track number one. I need to give the CD to Sangeeta, our sound engineer, so that she can play it. But Richard, tell me why you've chosen this.
Sure. Well, interestingly, back to, again, that early days, life sort of was a bit chaotic for me back in the early 90s. And I met this amazing lady, Lorraine, and we used to play this track. I used to have a CD player in my car, and we put this on track, and we used to play it end to end as we were in the old days courting. She's still my wife now. We've got two amazing boys, and she's sacrificed a lot for me. And in being able, she's a nurse at the Children's Hospital, which is amazing, but she's also had to sacrifice a lot for me to be able to do what I've done with Kings, really. Without her, I couldn't have done it. Therefore, this track is dedicated to her.
Sister Sledge, Thinking of You.
We're open for Business Live.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. Now, would you like to be on the programme, or would you like to comment on something going on in business or social enterprise that affects you? Well, you can get in touch. Just send an email to jamie@sheffieldlive.org. Send a text message to 07904 272200. Find me, Jamie Veitch, on Twitter. Find Sheffield Live on Twitter as well. Whether you're running or starting a business or a social enterprise, whether you're an employer, an employee, self-employed, we'd love to hear from you. So get in touch. And today we've been talking about sport and how the value of sport and physical activity can be fantastic in terms of creating community and engaging children in sport. And I'm talking today with Richard Holmes, Chief Executive of the King's Foundation. Richard's absolutely passionate himself about the value of sports and physical activity. Richard, welcome back.
Thank you.
So we've been talking about King's Foundation, the impressive work that you've been doing all over the UK, but internationally as well. Now, clearly you're passionate about sport yourself. I know that you're a keen cyclist. We've been talking about the hills of the Peak District.
Absolutely.
Riding your bike, it's something you do quite regularly.
It is, yeah. Sport has always been really important. We were talking earlier before we came on air. My childhood memories of school were mixed, but definitely sport was my main reason for going to school.
Right.
It was a thing I was good at and I enjoyed. Played football for many years. And then when my football time came to an end, my dad had always road cycled, and I'd never been interested. And I look back with regrets, actually, that I didn't take a keener interest in what he was interested in. I was too busy doing my own thing, but that's what young people do. And then when I quit football, I started to do some more general fitness training, and then started to do some road cycling, and very quickly learnt just how amazing Sheffield is. To have the Peak District on our doorstep.
Yes.
Playing football, you don't tend to see the Peak District. You tend to sort of see inner city areas and play football, which is fine. But suddenly I'd had this Peak District on my doorstep all my life, and yet I didn't know it at all. And then suddenly I'm on this bike and this freedom and this getting out in the great outdoors, in all weathers, and seeing these amazing places, towns, views, roads. And so, yeah, I'm an avid road cyclist. I'm a bit of a cycling evangelist now. I absolutely love cycling and try and cycle as often as I can. At this time of year, maybe four times a week. Really keen on road cycling.
Right, grand. Well, as you say, you're living in a fantastic place for it. And with the Peak District so near, there are so many hills to test your fitness on.
Yeah, so it's certainly an amazing place to train. I've got friends in the down south, in the southeast. In fact, my twin sister lives in Abingdon near Oxford, and she's a keen road cyclist these days, but most of her routes are flat.
Yes.
And so we have the privilege of hills. Privilege or pain or both, I think.
That
so you
probably
have to embrace both. but it does make for very interesting riding, and obviously it's just great for your well-being and fitness.
Yes, most definitely. Super. Okay, well, I hope you get to cycle this weekend. The weather looks like it should be good, better than today.
Absolutely.
Indeed. Now, we've been talking about King's Foundation and the phenomenal impact that you've had over the years working with so many children and with young people. You've talked also, frankly, about challenges and about leadership and really great advice for people as well. And you've given a book recommendation too. We love book recommendations on this radio show. We always try and get them. So your biggest career achievements, I suppose, whether it's personal, for the organisation or a mixture, what are you most proud of in what King's has done?
I think it's the small moments for me. I think every year, at the beginning of July, we start our camps in Scotland, and then we're running all our summer programme all the way through to the end of August. And every year, I try and do a road trip and take in as many of our locations. We've got 62 this year, so yep. It's a tall order from Aberdeen right the way down to Plymouth. It's a tall order to get around all of them, but I try and do that, a road trip for 2 or 3 days a week over 3 months and see all of our programmes. And nearly every week, at least every week, I'll stand there and I'll just watch what we do. And it's simplest form. And I'll watch, I was in Nottingham at Easter, not a big camp, maybe 40 or 50 children. And I watched these teen girls playing something called Capture the Flag, which is a very simple game, it's like a wide game, if you like, with these young leaders. And they were just children being children, young people, teen girls particularly. You know, there's tremendous social media pressure on them, tremendous pressure to conform, to be something perhaps they don't want to be. And we provide this week, this freedom week, where children can be children. So it's the simple things I'm most proud of,
right,
is when I see those young leaders inspiring those teen girls and those younger kids just to be children, to see the smile on their faces. They're running around, having fun with their friends, learning all sorts of skills. I think it's those moments that make me most proud. I can point to numbers and landmarks and things, and we've done a lot of that, but actually it's the transformation of young people and children that I'm most passionate about. It still provides me with those moments where I have to sort of, yeah, a bit choked up, to be honest. When I see those things, they're emotional moments, because it makes all the hard work, behind the scenes work, and there is a lot of work that goes into is a very simple, on the surface, a simple program. There's a lot of hard work goes behind the scenes, and it makes it all worthwhile. Day to day, I go into an office. I'm not out having fun. I sit at a computer. We have management meetings. We sit in meetings. We do all of the mundane things. We have to run our finances, our operations, our recruitment, all those things. We have to do GDPR. There's all that background stuff. And without that, we couldn't do what we do. But it makes it worthwhile when you see that transformation on people's faces. And I guess the other thing I'd point to is some of the impact we've had on other organisations. We've definitely changed the culture in the cruise industry, which wasn't child-friendly at all. Mm. And we've played, I think, a significant part in that. So that'd be another thing. And the third thing would be our work in Southern Africa. That's been a very, very amazing personal privilege. But to take, export what we've done in the UK and to go and impact at community level, in very disadvantaged communities often, and to see them now using sport as a tool to engage children, bring communities together. They're the things, they're the landmarks that we live for at King's.
Right. Absolutely fantastic. Well, we could ask you so many more questions. Yeah. We have about a minute left of the programme to do so. So I know you've got a couple of things coming up in Sheffield. Yeah. You talked about 62 locations all over the UK in terms of camps, but you've got something coming up in Sheffield in terms of activity events. So
another part of our programme is we do active play sessions in schools, where we go in, we've got an amazing team of guys that go in and they do short active play sessions in schools to model best practice, to help teaching assistants, etc., to know what to do with sport and with kids. And we're running 4 family events throughout June, 3 weekends in Encliffe Park,
yep,
Saturdays from 11 till 2 o'clock, one of those in Concord Park. And there for anyone to come, all families, all ages, to come and get involved, and we'll be running loads of activities, be loads of fun, free events, no charge. And it's a way of us celebrating our history in Sheffield, and we're looking forward to getting hundreds of families involved with that. So they can go to kingscamps.org is the best place to go for any of this information. And that, if they go kingscamps.org and go to the Sheffield part of that page, site, it will take you to these free events. And we hope to see lots and lots of families involved in Saturdays in Encliffe Park throughout June.
And Cliff and Concord
and
as well.
And Concord as well. We're running something in conjunction with... It's all part of Move More, Sheffield Initiative. Yeah. So we're part of that with the council.
Great.
British Cycling are running something in Concord and we're running on the back of that as well.
Excellent. Superb. So that's been absolutely fascinating, Richard. Really... guess who can't get a word out today?
Okay.
A privilege to speak with you today. And I'd love you to give the website address out once more.
So. Okay, so there's two sites I'd send you to. Is kingscamps.org, which is goes to our campsite. And if you want to know more about the whole work of the foundation, it's kingsfoundation.org.
Wonderful. So King's Camps and King's Foundation. I will tweet the links to those sites out as well. And Richard Holmes, Chief Exec, King's Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. You can get in touch, send a text message, send an email, find me on Twitter. Text 07904 272 200. Twitter, Jamie Veitch or Sheffield Live. And email jamie@sheffieldlive.org. We'll be back on air next Friday from 9 through to 10 a.m. then. But don't go away now, because next up on Sheffield Live is our fantastic folk music programme. Thank goodness it's folk. Thank goodness indeed, from 10 all the way through to noon. So stay tuned for that. Our guest today has been fascinating. Richard Holmes, Chief Executive of the King's Foundation. If you've only just tuned in and you've missed Richard, panic not. The podcast will be up on the Sheffield Live website from about 11 a.m. today. That's it for today. Thank you so much for listening to the programme. Thank you, Richard, our great guest today. And thank you, Sangeeta, in the studio as our sound engineer. And we'll play out with a bit of Royal Blood. How did we get so dark?
We're open for Business Live.